This Choircast podcast is brought to you by The Wages of Grace, a novel by Brandon Dragan. What is the worst thing a person could do to you that you could still forgive? The Wages of Grace is the story of two immigrant brothers, Thierry and Marty Larocque, driven apart by a shocking event in their past that still haunts them into their old age. Thierry and Hope were the fairy tale couple, but while he was away fighting in the Second World War, Hope died in the most suspect of circumstances, and the last person to see her alive was Thierry's older brother, Marty. For decades, Thierry has wrestled with the thought that his older brother is responsible for the loss of his one true love, and now the brothers find their fates intertwined once more. This novel begs the question, is there any chasm that forgiveness cannot cross, and is there any wound that grace cannot heal? The Wages of Grace is available on Amazon, Audible, and everywhere books are sold.
Welcome to Reframing Our Stories, the podcast. This podcast is about provocative conversations with beautiful thinkers about topics that matter and the stories that have helped them reframe their lives. Grab something cozy or put on your walking shoes and let's reframe. We're really glad that you are back. And if you are liking our podcast, we really want to reach more people. So we would love for you to share it with your friends, give us a review so that more people can find us. And, you know, we also want to hear from you. So if you have a story to share, just reach out to us. We have a website called reframingourstories.com. And on there, you can hit the contact button and you can just write us a message and say, I would love to share a story on your podcast. And then we can reach out to you and see if it's a fit. So thank you again for continuing to come back here and to listen to these wonderful people and their stories. So one of the questions that I have been asking to youth when I teach sex education is this: what do you want adults to know? I find this to be one of the most interesting questions as of late, and I get a variety of different answers. But for those who are older, who are in high school, the responses have been somewhere around this. We want adults to know that our relationships will not look like yours. And then I follow up saying, well, what does that mean? Say more. And then they say, we may not be with just one person. It's clear that that doesn't always work. We think it is okay to have more than one partner as long as everyone knows about it. So I say, are you referring to polyamory? And the response is yes. In one of my former interviews, it was with Kelly Edison, and who opened up about her marriage, or who she talked about how she opened up her marriage, excuse me, and it is in the top 10 of my most downloaded episodes. People were curious. I thought it would be appropriate then to talk to a person who regularly works with people who are in polyamorous relationships. So today we will be spending time with Dr. Jolie Hamilton. Dr. Jolie Hamilton is the relationship coach for couples who color outside the lines. She is a research psychologist, TEDx speaker, best-selling author, and ASECT-certified sex educator. Jolie also co-hosts the Project Relationship podcast with her anchor partner, Ken. Jolie's been featured in the New York Times, Vogue, NPR, and The Atlantic. She spent the past two decades studying and reimagining what love can be if we open our imaginations to possibility. Jolie helps people create non-monogamous partnerships that are custom-built for their authentic selves. No more shrinking, pretending, or hiding required. Jolie, I'm so excited to have you on my show. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Kara.
Yes, this is great. One of the things that stood out for me really was in your bio, and with the last line in which you said, there's no more shrinking, pretending, or hiding required. Mm. And so my question is, when people come to talk to you about opening their marriage or polyamory, Is that what you see? Is that people have felt like they've been living that way?
You know, often people who find my work are, they have had a realization, right? Something has crossed their imagination. So sometimes they don't even realize that they had been hiding or shrinking or pretending, but they had a realization. And then there's another group of people who show up, and what happens is they've been squishing themselves to try to fit into a box because they weren't presented any options about building mm-hmm. conscious relationships. Mm-hmm. And so they've been trying, oftentimes they've been trying for decades to fit into a very monocentric, heteronormative world. And they may even have successfully fit into it. They may have raised children with someone and done all the things they were, big air quotes here, supposed to.
Sure.
And then they get to a spot where they're like, when will I get to be all of me? When will that happen? So mm-hmm. often people find me between, say, the ages of like 35 and 55 is broadly. But, you know, when the kids are kind of doing their own thing enough to take a breath, to take a beat, yeah. whether that's like when they start school or when it's when they're launching, that's often when. And all of a sudden, yeah, there is a recognition that, oh, I haven't been being authentic to myself. And it's now it hurts. It's like shoes that are too small.
That is fascinating to me because I feel like that is what I've been finding as I've been learning more about polyamory. It's like either I see it in, you know, the 20s, the, you know, people mm-hmm. who are in college and coming out of college and are like this, you know, I don't want to say, quotation traditional route is not what I want. It's not for me. It doesn't make sense for me. And then I see it in people who are late 40s and in their 50s yeah. who are opening up to that. So that's interesting that you said that.
Yeah. I think too, there is a moment in our life, right, where we're mm-hmm. making some decisions, and a large majority of people, even if they know that they want something non-traditional, they still often will pick a person to like settle down and have kids with, do that thing. Yeah. And so even if they have in their mind, like, yeah, we're going to be open or we are open, they may even have had those conversations, but then they can go on for years talking about that as like an idea. Yeah, like, yeah, that'll be cool. But like, oh my God, we just don't have the bandwidth, or oh my God, we just can't, whatever it is. And allowing enough time to pass so that the kids and the life starts to solidify under you. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And now we realize, okay, yeah, sure, life maybe feels a little bit more solid, but maybe it also feels stagnant, or it feels stuck, or perhaps your partner has come to you and they're feeling stagnant and stuck. And you might be like, yeah, I'm fine. Like I'm here for what I signed on for. So mm-hmm. if even one person in a partnership is feeling this way, then we got to deal with it. And that doesn't necessarily mean everything's going to work out hunky-dory, but it also doesn't necessarily mean everything has to fall apart.
Well, I think some of the things too, that when people start hearing the word polyamory, there's a lot of emotion that comes with it. And part of that, where you just said, I don't have the bandwidth, like I've heard many people say, it's intriguing, but I couldn't even imagine handling all those emotions. I can't imagine being in these relationships. And then you have people who are like, how can people even do that? It's not right. And then, you know, there's just a lot that comes with it that people are feeling. So right. Can you tell us more, if you could just tell us more about the history of polyamory? Because like most sexuality topics that we talk about, it's been around.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. We're not inventing something brand new here.
Right. No. It's not new. And why do you think there is more people practicing it today?
Yeah. So let's first just say that this idea of polyamory, that word, mm-hmm. the word itself isn't that old, you know, we're talking on the order of decades. It's also a very, you know, it came out of a very particular cultural explosion of like free love and like, let's shift the way love is handled. The countercultural movement, right, of the 60s mm-hmm. through say the 90s even. Mm-hmm. But non-monogamy? Well, non-monogamy, it literally has to exist. As soon as you posit the premise of monogamy, non-monogamy exists, first off. It just does, right?
Yeah.
But also, if we think about any intact culture, any culture that has not been presented with the one way to have relationships is to marry a person of a an opposite gender, right? Like, and mm-hmm. do it this way, get in that box.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you look away from that particular prescription, well, non-monogamy exists in lots of cultures during lots and lots of epochs, like lots of times. It is just another way to relate. Mm-hmm. However, when we think about the history, we have to also think about the context of the history, right? So each of us exists here mostly knowing, you know, what we were raised with. Maybe we know back to our grandparents' generation. Mm-hmm. We don't really feel into, like, what was it like when everyone was getting married? Because you married for survival. You right. married so that you had someone to partner with you because you were literally not going to grow enough food in the ground and have birth enough children to do. This is just, it is so contextual. So the history of polyamory is can be thought of in a couple ways. We can think about it as a modern shift to having conscious relationships that allow for multiple loves to simultaneously exist.
Mm-hmm.
But we could also broaden that conversation and say, well, it's also multicultural. It is timeless. It is a practice that, I mean, we see it in the Bible, right? Like it's right there, right? Like mm-hmm. having multiple wives is not an uncommon thing to read in the Bible, right? And mm-hmm. there are so many other cultures where we can easily see that having a multiplicity of partners is not a problem, but right. that's because the cultural context around them allows for it. And so mm-hmm. right now we're existing in a cultural context where we may not know anyone or think we know anyone
mm-hmm.
who's polyamorous. But mm-hmm. since the numbers are around 5% of people in most of the most recent studies we have, right? That means that that's as many people, and 20% of people have tried it at some point. Like, that is so many people. If you just think about how many friends you have, how many connections you have, and most people are not able to be out about it. So we know that those numbers are underreported, just like all other marginalized populations.
Mm-hmm.
If you might face blowback in your life, then mm-hmm. you probably aren't going to share that detail with everyone. So a mm-hmm. lot of times people are practicing some form of consensual non-monogamy, but they're not talking about it publicly because they don't know who it's safe to talk about it with.
And seeing that I do work in the Christian sphere, as a sex educator, as you can imagine, many people come and tell me things.
Yeah.
And I know that there are many Christians who are also polyamorous. Do you want to speak to that? Do you have clients who are, and can you speak to that?
I do. I think it's been interesting for me. So I was raised in the Christian church, and I don't consider myself an active Christian now. Mm-hmm. I have no problems with the words of Jesus. All good. But I don't find myself in church every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's so interesting. I think there is something about my own upbringing, which was I enjoyed church. There's something very communal, right? There's something very, like, I feel held in this community.
Mm-hmm.
That's not entirely unlike what people are often seeking when they're seeking polyamory. So I think there's actually some resonance for a lot of people. And yet we don't talk about it. So I actually have quite a few clients. So I run a group program called the Year of Opening, and mm-hmm. I also work privately with clients. Mm-hmm. And in both of those scenarios, I have multiple clients who consider themselves Christian, who show up, they're in their faith communities, and they like that. And they also have found that they are either polyamorous or perhaps another label of non-monogamy works for them. Some of them consider themselves swingers. Some of them consider themselves to be open, but still hierarchical. So they wouldn't necessarily say that they're polyamorous yet. Some of them are just exploring and they don't even know. I'm just trying to figure out, well, if we're not doing traditional monogamy, right? This idea of traditional monogamy, which, by the way, is not very old. Read like Stephanie Kuhn's A Short History of Marriage. The version of monogamy we have right now, talking like 125 years. So it's not very old. But if we're going to even call that traditional, if you step outside of that, what do we do? And often the big trouble that they run into is there's fear about being exposed for something that in fact is enriching their life, something that they are finding is incredibly satisfying and brings more love into their world.
Right.
It's a terrible thing to have to hide that.
Right.
So, they're often seeking more community around, like, how do I feel like this is safe and normal and mm-hmm. I'm not going to be ostracized about it?
I feel that's the thing that always kind of brings me sadness is, you know, any sort of, you know, the fact of queer love or different things like this, right? Like where the society has issue where I'm like, all that's happening is people are living into their authentic selves and are learning how to love themselves and others. That's what's happening.
That's it. That's what's happening.
Why are we having such a big problem with this, right? Like, this is the things that even as a teenager, I remember thinking, like, I don't understand if people are just loving. why is that? Why are we so upset about that?
Yeah. And you know? I would broaden that even to say, you know, let's take a broad vision of what it is to love, because even people who are practicing polysexuality, right, maybe they are not building, you know, hugely long lasting multiple partnerships. Maybe they have decided to limit it and it's more of a swinging type situation. I've seen intensely loving communities of people mm-hmm. practicing that, right? Like, so they may not be intentionally building the in love feeling, but maybe they're loving each other authentically in their bodies and allowing space for that multiplicity and allowing space for exploring your authentic sexuality with your partner, with other people, and to be witnessed in that. So it's not secretive. It's not cheating, because let's just face it, there's another kind of non-monogamy that happens all the time too. Because cheating's non-monogamy too, right? So it's about the honesty. So what I'm hearing, and I think you just said this beautifully, it's about people loving authentically and honestly. Right. And if they're doing that, so the other option is that people are being dishonest with themselves, with others. You know, we see this happening every day and we know it's happening. And constricting people's sexuality and constricting their relational choices hasn't worked. Right. It has not produced like happier connections. It has not produced, you know, fail-proof marriages. Mm-hmm. So.
And I think so much of that.
Okay.
Yeah. And I feel like so much of that too, with what you were talking about before around cheating and different things, is I feel like that is where fear sets in and where people who have experienced that or who have done that live with a sense of fear in a sense, right? Of like, of, and that's, I think, also where like attachment styles come in and things like this and trauma that hasn't been worked through.
Right.
Things like that.
Often, often I find that people who want to be more open, often there is a fair recovery going on. Often there has been some non-consensual, non-monogamy going on, right? Like there has been some, even if it was unintentional, it happens. And now we actually have two issues. Now we're doing a fair recovery. We're like, we're trying to find our feet again together.
Right.
While also a lot of times people are like, oh, you know what? I don't think monogamy works for me. I think that's why this happened.
Sure.
Oh, now we got to get into it, because most of the time when I'm meeting with people who are in this scenario, they've never had really clear relationship agreements. They had left themselves open to the possibility often for a long time. I call it like, just think about like, do you leave that window open? Is there any room in your consciousness for experiencing multiplicity of love, of sexuality? And if there is, then it is possible at some point you will step outside your marriage. And if that's possible,
interesting,
then I would so much rather have the conversation about, let's have really clear agreements. Because if what you've decided is you're not going to step outside your marriage and you're going to do that, well, okay, get real clear about where the boundaries are so that you know them. If you think you're at risk for being non-consensual, you need to clarify this all the more, not leave yourself more wiggle room.
Right.
And it's tricky because most people aren't having like those relationships.
That's what I was just going to say. And I feel like, well, one, I feel like there's this element where we're not even taught how to have those conversations. It's rare that we're even looking at our own sense of boundaries and what does that mean?
Right.
You know, and then the fact that over time boundaries often can change as we change as humans, right?
Yeah,
as individuals.
We grow.
Yeah. And so I feel like those are the conversations too that we need to be having more of. And to talk, like when I go and teach kids, I try to actually teach some of this stuff of like, what is it that feels good for you now? What are those boundaries? What does a boundary mean? How do we learn how to work with those, and how do we set those in motion and let people understand them? And so it's a lot.
And so frequently I have people come to me who, when I ask them questions like, okay, so what are your relationship agreements now? Like, you know, just monogamy. And I'll dig a little bit deeper and dig a little deeper. And what we find is that either there's an expectation that they each actually, like, they each have an internal expectation. Like they have a sense of boundaries, but they haven't made it explicit. So I like to help people move things out of the implicit expectation into the explicit agreement, but also leave some space for the fact that, you're going to grow and change, and you're going to need ways to repair when those boundaries get bumped up against, because they're going to. At some point, your boundaries are going to get bumped up against. And sometimes I actually hear people come into my practice and, you know, they'll say, I'll ask what their boundaries are. And they're like, well, I don't feel like I should need any with my monogamous partner. I shouldn't need any. That's like, that's the vision of true love that they have, is I won't need to, right?
Oh,
one, my partner. Yeah. My partner will know me so well. They will never violate my boundaries, which is such it is a trick. It is a trap you're setting for them and for yourself, because now you don't actually necessarily even know what those boundaries are. What you're doing is going by that sense of like, I'll know it when it's violated.
I feel like we can thank rom-com and Disney for that, right? Like,
yeah, they have definitely done a darn good job of nailing that together. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hate to
so
say
unfortunate. And I love a good rom-com, but we need to be able to look at them with a critical eye. And and most of us were raised imagining that that's what we should hope for. And you know, so frequently I have people tell me that, like, I don't want to have boundaries. I don't want to have agreements. I just want it to flow. I don't want it to, it, like, if it's real, it won't need all this work. You know, I mean, I don't think that personally, I don't see relationship work as work. My experience of relationship work is that all that stuff, agreement making, negotiating, helping my partner understand my boundaries and inviting them closer into intimacy with me, that is the relationship. That is the building of connection.
Mm.
And I think we make a mistake when we sort these things out into two buckets and we say, like, I just want connection. I don't want to do all that stuff. That stuff is the connection.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be yummy. It doesn't have to be ick. But if you leave it for years and years and years and years, I mean, I don't want to leave any, like, I have to sweep the kitchen floor every day too. I have to have hard conversations with my partner, you know, week to week. I do. I have to have vulnerability present every day.
Well, that's the key, right? Is the vulnerability. And that's the, again, like, what I think there's fear around, because the moments when maybe we've expressed that before and it's been hurt, and, you know, learning how to then continue to show up and be in those spaces. And, you know, like, I'm just going to say, I'm a sucker for all the reality dating shows. Just let's be real.
I mean, hey, you got to get your, it's like candy for your brain, right?
It's
like, it's
true.
Not good, but like, right? it's not good, but yeah.
Right. Like, I've been watching, you know, The Ultimatum recently.
I just watched The Queer Ultimatum. Literally just watched it this past weekend, because I was everybody talked about it. I totally missed the boat and didn't watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with you. Like, you watch it, and one of the things we see is like, oh my gosh, we as a group are missing the boat of true vulnerability, exposing ourselves to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
it's because, and I'm going to say this, I've been really thinking about like the American culture recently, because I did a lot of traveling this summer. We were offered this gift of travel, and I've just been paying attention. We slowed down. We were going at a slower pace. And you look at what has been happening, like, in our country, and I almost feel Like when you actually that the American culture, and you can tell me if you think I'm wrong, almost punishes us for being vulnerable. Like yeah, there is this sure. essence of we always have to go show that you're strong. Don't show your weakness. Continue forward. And I'm like, the way our systems are even set up, I think is destroying relationships because of the way of like how we have been programmed to live. And I feel like there's this, it's like we're so busy and are forced to try, you know, to go against the grind that we are, or go with the grind that we are disconnected from our bodies and disconnected mm-hmm. from what our needs are. And then it's almost like we don't even have the energy mm-hmm. to even right. put into the relationships that are in front of us. Yeah.
Right. So when people say they don't have the bandwidth, I'm like, okay, do you want to create the bandwidth?
Yes.
Like, let's talk about that. Because
how do you do that? Like, how do you
help people with that? I spend an enormous amount of my life energy on my relationships, an enormous amount. And all the rest of it is spent on other forms of relationships. Honestly, I think I spend almost all of my life force on relationships. In mm-hmm. relationships with my children, with my friends, with my community, with my favorite baristas. Like it's everywhere, right? My yoga teacher. I'm in relationship to myself. I would agree with you that the cultural, so I trained as a Jungian psychologist. So I studied mm-hmm. the work of Carl Jung. There's a theme put forward by Samuel Andrews and some other post-Jungians about the cultural complex. And it comes out of a seed of Jung's work where he talks about each nation having a complex, right? Each nation having this way, like, mm-hmm. so he's Swiss, right? So he would talk about how, you know, the Swiss are intensely private. They literally, there's mountains all around their country and yeah. they're walled off. Their banking system is walled off from everybody else. Like, right. They are a walled off closed. And then that cultural complex is in the archetypal basis for all of the people, the sure. ones who are born there and live there, and then the ones who decide to go live there and swim in that milieu, as it mm-hmm. were. The same can be said for any nation. I guess another way we might describe that, when people come home from vacation and they tell me they're on island time, I'm like, oh, you were swimming in another cultural matrix. You're swimming in that, right? And you felt it, even though it's not mm-hmm. your cultural stuff. Mm-hmm. You felt how that changed your way of being.
Yes.
Yeah. And the American cultural complex is one of domination.
Yes.
Right? We dominate.
100%. Yeah.
Okay. Is it any wonder that so many of us are exhausted? So many of us want to submit in the bedroom. So many of us are, right? Like we could take this in so many directions, right? Because yeah. domination is just, it's everywhere. And poorly held domination. You know, there's yeah. a big difference between skillfully held domination that can balance itself mm-hmm. with rest, with caretaking, and with submission. That is not what we got going on. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. It is not. Oh no.
Yeah. No, that's great. And I just had a conversation with someone about the whole phrase that I've been hearing kids say constantly is, well, I'm better than you at this. And there's that whole domination thing too happening yep. there, but also needing to find our sense of worth by minimizing others. And like yep. that again, to me is a disconnect and not the connection that we are trying to establish to have these
yeah.
relationships with ourselves and others. Yeah.
I have private clients all the time who talk about feeling they're struggling with their individuation, struggling mm-hmm. with who they want to become, who they're trying to become. And a thing I hear frequently that's so in line with that is, well, I'm not the best at anything. Mm. I'm not the best at anything, because that's how they've decided to mark like their value, yeah. their worth, right? Unless yeah. they are the best at something, then screw it. Never mind, I guess. And so then you hit a certain age and you're like, well, now no matter how hard I train, I couldn't be the best at this, or I couldn't be the best at, yeah. Mm-hmm. That is, it's an American thing for sure. Mm. I'm sure there are other cultures that share that particular thing, but when it comes to our relationships, if we have this best at, that is going to translate over into another theme that I see show up and break people's multiple relationships a lot, which is the idea that I have to be chosen. I need to be your best person.
This is, this is kind of what I was wondering too, because people, the other thing, and we can just go right into this, is people are like, well, what about jealousy? Like, I would be so jealous. I would feel like I am not good enough, you know? And so then what, talk to us about that whole chosen piece, and then how does that play out?
Yeah. Okay. So first I want to just say I study jealousy specifically. That is my academic research area of interest. Okay. So I am currently, I'm actually in the second half of a very interesting study on jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
Jealousy is, generally speaking, it is just one of a whole bunch of emotions that will come up and kick us in the butt when we start to do relationship work. But let's dig into it, because that phrase, like, oh, I could never do non-monogamy because I'm too jealous. I'm a jealous person. I could never do that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to establish a few baselines. First off, no one is a jealous person any more than you are an angry person or a sad person, but some of us are more sensitive to particular emotions and we feel more overwhelmed, right? Some people fall into a depressive state really easily. Some people fly off the handle really easily. Some people experience jealousy more fluently, and that doesn't necessarily feel good. And so it's true that if you have multiple relationships, you are opening the door to the potential for feeling jealous, for feeling unchosen, the potential. However, that's true in monogamy too. Monogamy doesn't actually protect us from that. My most recent study, so my first studies were on consensual non-monogamy and polyamorous people and how they handle jealousy. And then next, the follow-up study was on monogamous people. And there are some differences. And one of them is that monogamous people don't expect to have to deal with jealousy, right? Mm-hmm. They think that the monogamy itself is going to protect them. And so when it comes up, it is. Right. And there's no place to talk about it because you're not supposed to have to. And it means bad things about you. And it is upsetting. And now I'm in a spiral. And even if I do talk to someone, they don't know anything about it. They don't know. We were not taught culturally. We are not taught to deal with jealousy at all. So we can go through how jealousy forms in us and then why jealousy feels so overwhelming. But the very first thing I like people to do is just reimagine the fact that you don't currently have tools for working with jealousy. So if you want to shift to opening, then you're going to need to have those tools. Yeah. And you may or may not be a you know, more tenderly jealous person. I happen to be married to somebody who is not very sensitive to jealousy. It's not a big problem for him. It's not that he doesn't feel jealousy. He very much does. But when he does, he's really well resourced and he understands what to do with it next. And so he manages it really well. I am a super highly jealous individual. Like, I'm very, very sensitive to it. And so I also have to know my tools and know how to deal with it and dig in and access my resources. It's hard, but it was hard when I was monogamous too. I was jealous of my partner's friends. I was jealous of everyone they talked to. So
how did that change? I mean, you're still experiencing, you know, jealousy. So then how did that transfer over for you then when you started opening your marriage? And then what are some of the tools that you have utilized to help with that?
Yeah. So when I was monogamous, I thought that jealousy was something I shouldn't have to feel. So the very first tool that I started employing, and this was a hard one. Oh my gosh. First, I tried to just get rid of the word jealousy. We actually banned it in our house. Brilliant move. Ban a word. That'll definitely help. It doesn't help. Never ban words. Never ban words. It does the opposite. All that happened is everything became about jealousy then, because it couldn't be spoken. It was like Voldemort. Right. Don't do that.
Right.
It's not
right.
Good.
It's like Voldemort.
Yeah. So then what I realized is that since jealousy wasn't going away just because I willed it away, I had to get closer to it. Now, my way of getting closer to it was to put myself directly in its path and start working on it as if it were just like any other emotion, as if it has, and this is a great tool everyone can use. The jealousy has information for you. Most people don't actually notice that they're feeling jealous because they feel all the other emotions that jealousy brings along with it. Jealousy is a complex emotion. Your jealousy is going to show up with a flavor. It might be angry, sad, deeply fearful, very anxious, and not really have a thing to point at. It might be filled with shame or confusion. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes people don't name jealousy. So maybe we should just define it.
Yeah.
Jealousy is the protective emotion that you experience when you are noticing a threat to a valued love bond. So you notice the threat and now that's jealousy. So it's actually really simple. And that means a lot of us experience jealousy all the time. Like it happens all the time. Yeah. No big deal. What most people think about when they think about jealousy is like big, explosive jealousy, right? Like they're thinking about like knockdown dragouts. They're thinking about people, you know, stalking each other and doing terrible things. But we experience very banal, mundane jealousy all the time. It just happens. The way that we can spot it is by noticing, can I find the triangle? Because jealousy is always in a triangle. It's me. If I'm the jealous one, it's me, my beloved, and my perceived interrupter. The one who's going to interrupt, the one who is the threat. And the perceived interrupter may be a real person who you see. Like you could look across a party and see somebody talking to your partner and be like, they are literally interrupting right now. Mm-hmm. But it can also be an imaginal person that you sort of invent out of who's pressing like on Facebook and Instagram posts. Who are they working with, but you haven't even met their coworkers, but you have this imagination. Who are they, you know, going to martial arts classes and touching and interacting with, right? We can invent a person. Mm-hmm. But if you can spot that triangle, then you've got jealousy on the scene, shall we say. And that jealousy now needs to get handled, but most of us were not taught. Like I said before, we weren't taught anything to do with it. So we initially have jealousy because we needed it, right? It's a protective mechanism. It's there to keep us connected to our primary caregiver when we are still completely vulnerable, right? Yeah. We need them to care for us. And any interruption to that is a huge threat to our very existence. So we go into survival mode. And then we grow into toddlers and siblings come along, playmates come along, like other little people are in the world. Our other parent may actually want to interact with the primary caregiver that we actually like the most. Mm-hmm. We feel interruption. And what are we told? We're told, share your toys, share your time and attention, share everything. But we're not usually told anything about the feeling of jealousy itself. The feeling like, oh, you're feeling jealous. What's going on in there? Is that jealousy feeling like angry jealousy? Does it make you want to hurt somebody? Mm-hmm. Is it feeling really sad? Do you want to go cut yourself off? Do you want to go hide and stick your head under the pillow? Do you feel totally numb? Are you completely numb and you can't feel it, right? And so if we got that education when we were preschool aged, right? And up through our elementary years, it would be completely different. Then jealousy, instead, we were told to share everything. And we're not actually taught how to, we're just told to share, right? Mm-hmm. And so we shove jealousy under the covers and then we just press fast forward on our life and it shows up again.
We get the twisted knots in our tummy and we don't pay attention.
All the things. Yeah, the sensations of jealousy are remarkable. Mm-hmm. You will know it when you feel it. Mm-hmm. And then where does it show up again? When we fall in love, when we find ourselves in relationship. And I want to broaden the in love here. It can show up when we have special friends, like our best friend in middle school. Yes. It can show up. So it's any three people can create this dynamic, right? It doesn't have to just be romantic. But when it's in our romantic relationships, especially those early ones, oh my gosh, so overwhelming. Because what are we doing? We're now cast back into a toddler's mindset. We have no tools and now we're back in that embodied state, right? So
I also feel like we're told, oh, you're fine. Like,
you're fine. There's nothing really happening.
You're fine. Just get over it. Or like, no, or we're redirected, right? Like we don't want to deal with the hard emotion. So we're redirecting.
Right. You know? Mm-hmm. Totally. And I think back to, I have seven kids. So I think back to when my own kids were little, they're grown now. But when they were little, there was a lot of like, let's just redirect their energy. You know, there's never enough time, it feels like, to deal with all the things.
Oh gosh.
Like, so as a parent, I'm like, yeah, I think I did the best I could. And I know by watching my grown children, I didn't nail this either. This is a hard one.
It's super hard.
Super hard. And if I haven't sat with my own jealousy, if I haven't sat with my own need to be the special chosen one and to always be picked, if I haven't sat with that, it's going to be really hard for me to sit with my kids in that pain.
Mm.
And most of us don't, right? Most of us don't have an opportunity to, and it's hard. We can sympathize with our kids then, but we can't necessarily really be with that big emotion because it's terrifying to us too. Mm-hmm. And that can wake us up into all the stuff where we're like, yeah, you shouldn't have to feel jealous. Let's go fix this relationship. Because if there's jealousy present, then something's wrong.
Right.
But it's just information. And sometimes it's not even accurate information. So if we go back to, well, what happens when you truly are not chosen? Let's say my partner is out on a date. He was out last night. And so I have an anchor partner that I live with. I happen to be married to him. We co-parent children, right? So we have a pretty traditional looking life. And he was out last night. And my experience could be that I wasn't chosen. Hmm. And that does pop up. And I have to go through, I actually have a jealousy plan. Like, what do I do to work with this?
Because what happens?
Yeah, what happens? And it's going to be unique for everyone. But I ask people to have a self-care playlist. Like, I want you to have your rescue playlist on your Spotify. I want you to put it on. I want that bad boy to be like 2 hours long. You start filling up your Spotify playlist with all the songs that help you remember. I want there to be no rom-com songs. There will be none, right. No Kelly Clarkson, Key in the Car. None of that. None of that. This is uplifting songs. These are songs that say, I am the light. I am here, right? Like all of that. And and put that together, put that on in the background. So this is part of my plan. I put that music on in the background. I engage with some of my spiritual practices, the ones especially that remind me that I am whole. I am here. I am whole. I am connected to the divine all the time. Mm-hmm. And that my relationship is beautiful and lovely, but it is not the definition of me. So I get into my practice, even if I don't want to. And there are a million things. Some people turn to their creative practice. You know, this is the time to go play your instrument, to sing, to paint, to do something with your hands. I knit. It is not the time to ruminate though. So I have to knit something complicated, right? Because if I just pearl stitch all day, I'm not getting there, right? So I have literally a post-it note that has like, this is my jealousy plan. So what I do is I follow my 5-step jealousy roadmap, which came out of my research. I didn't invent it. Like, this is just what the research says works for jealousy. I notice jealousy right away in my body. I'm like, oh, yep. Feel those knots in my stomach. Feel that heat. Kind of want to kill people. Okay. Probably jealousy since my partner's out. I'm going to say, I think this is probably jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
And I name it. I just say, that's the second step. I name it. I say, I'm feeling jealous, and that's okay. Like, that doesn't make me a bad person. It doesn't make me a bad polyamorous person. It doesn't mean this doesn't work.
Makes me human.
Makes me human. Just having emotions, having an emotion day, you know, like all the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And then I follow my jealousy plan and I just walk through it because I can't necessarily count on myself to intellectually be able to pull that all up. So I literally have it written down. What do I do? I also have the name of a friend who I can call who will not decide to say in that moment, you know, it's the non-monogamy. It's the polyamory. Told you, you need a friend who's safe. And that's part of why people come into my group program is a lot of us don't have that community. So I created community. Like, these are small cohort based, like there's only 20 people in each group. And that way you have some place to say like, I'm in it. I'm feeling it. This is really hard. My partner's out and I don't know what to do. And you're not alone. If you're currently experiencing jealousy and you feel like you're going to be told to change your relationship style rather than to learn to work with your emotions. Yeah. It's just so unhelpful. It's so unhelpful.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, there is like so much there.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm like sitting here. I'm like, I'm just like in it. And I feel like so much of this and I'm wondering, when people hear this stuff or where we talk about relationships or sexuality, so much of it does go back to our childhood.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and I think
formed our models.
Right. And so I think that for many of us, we have to learn how to care for that child, how to, you know, go to them as an adult and say, hey, like, we didn't learn this when we were younger. Let's work on this now. Let's be there together. Because I do also think there's this mind frame also of scarcity of, you know, you hear this all the time when you're watching these dating shows like I do, because yeah. I'm sadly obsessed.
Just a little self-injury, a little light self-injury there. No.
But it's mostly, I think I watch them because, you know, it's like sociology to me. I'm just like studying. I'm just like watching and seeing the, you know, the patterns. I like to look for patterns, right? Yeah. And on all of these, people say, I have to be chosen.
Yeah.
You need to choose me.
Yes. That's the thing. I have to be chosen.
Because mm-hmm. I have to be chosen. Yes.
Yeah, I heard that. So when I was watching The Ultimatum, that was one of the things that stood out to me, was how hard, like how deeply people feel that. And here's the thing. Great. You can. What if being chosen doesn't mean that your partner cuts all other people out? And this, we already mm-hmm. have an example of this. Most of us have close friends. Mm-hmm. If you have a close friend, or if you don't right now, but you did during high school or college, did your friend also have friends?
Right.
Right. Like we were socialized to normalize that. And we might have struggled with it even. I have definitely been in best friend situations where I'm like, ooh, I am so jealous that they mm-hmm. are off at dinner together. I'm like, I am in it. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we are socialized to say, okay, Jolie, that is your work to do. You know, she does right. not have to cancel her plans just because you don't feel chosen in this moment. Right. Because you are chosen. Is she your best friend? Yes. Has she reassured you? Yes. How do you understand that this is her being her out in the world? Yes. Like we go through all of that and then we choose a monogamous partner, and you can do that. If monogamy is working for you, great. No problem. Mm-hmm. But if you want to choose something else and you also are caught by this idea that being chosen means that your partner will reject everyone else, then there's the thing to meditate on.
Yeah.
Is that the same thing? Does right. being chosen mean that they have to reject everyone else? And if so, well, what does that mean about your partner's ability to have friends even? Because right. what are we talking about here?
Right. And this that is goes where, back to like the control thing and the power
thing. The control, the power, mm-hmm. and this in the domination, right? The American cultural domination, the need to have control over everything and to be able to understand exactly how everything is going to play out. Mm-hmm. When in reality, none of us know if our partner will be there tomorrow. I faced plenty of losses and deaths in my life. And mm-hmm. one of the things that I think that particular experience has given me is just the reality of like, tomorrow is never promised.
It's yeah.
And when I divorced 15 years ago, I went through a divorce and I didn't expect to. And then we did. Nothing in me thought that that could ever happen. And then it did. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you ask people who are divorced, that's a really, really incredibly common thing to hear. Like, I didn't expect it.
Yeah. I didn't think this was going to be my life.
Even if they are the one who instigated the separation, right? Like, because we love those stories of never rupturing connection. Mm-hmm. But connection is to some degree, I think connection exists because we experience rupture and reconnection, mm-hmm. right? And if we just think about, I have to build the skills to connect and reconnect to my partner. And that's a lot of what we do, like in my group work, in my private work, we're like working on the skills of agreement building. We're working on the skills of knowing who those, I call them your inner council members. You mentioned mm-hmm. your inner children. I call mm-hmm. them my inner council members because they're all different ages and they all have different personalities,
all different needs,
right? Like getting to know those, getting to know how they will feel. Like, mm-hmm. so I might be okay feeling like, yeah, I don't need to be chosen, but what does my inner teenager think? What does my mm-hmm. like really goth inner 15-year-old girl think? Because she is not down with that. And she has like a lot of attitude about it. And right. she talks exactly like that. Yeah. She has different feelings. And oh my gosh. I have to deal with that. So we really what we're doing is the skills that all of us need for healthy relating, for happy relating.
Yeah.
The non-monogamy is just sort of the inspiration for doing that work. But the skills are all exactly the same as they would be in any other relationship. And then you add to it the fact that you will be presented with unique opportunities to practice, which is awesome, which is really awesome.
Yeah, that has to be the exciting part of it too. Yeah. You know, like where you're like, oh, of, you know, because connecting is exciting, connecting. And I think part of that too is the recognition, recognizing that different people bring different parts of us to life too. Like different connections light us up in different ways, you know?
Right.
And I think the biggest myth that we've been given is that people have around marriage is that you have to have the person who's going to give you all of those things.
Right.
And that simply doesn't exist.
Right. It's a funny idea. I think based on a really limited imagination of how much want I could have, because I got to tell you, Kyra, I have a lot. I got a lot of want.
In a lot of different directions. I feel like that just like that phrase right there, a limited definition of how much want I have. Like that was great. let's put that on our throw pillow.
Right. And if I can fully admit how much want it is possible for me to have, well, I guess anybody right now listening could. You could just stop and think, if I knew the depths of my wants, my needs, if I knew all of them, if I let myself be aware of them, like really aware, and I let myself be in that place where I was like, okay, this is me, this is for real me, and it will be different tomorrow, but it's not going to be smaller.
Right.
Would I live the life I'm living right now?
Mm-hmm.
Would I be in the relationship structure that I'm in right now? Would I be with the person I'm with right now? And the answer might be yes. The answer might be no. But being with that question and really allowing yourself the permission to even contemplate how much want you have. I was meeting with somebody recently in a group session, and we were working through a bunch of activities. And one of the early activities is about needs, wants, desires, boundaries. And she was really struggling, like really struggling. And she said, I just don't feel like I have any needs. Like, and I was like, let's dig into that. But before I dug into it, I asked, well, how about wants? I definitely want things, but they're not mine. I want things that work for everyone. I want to take everyone into account. So talking about our family, she's like, I want to make sure everyone feels included. I want to take everybody's wants into account. I don't have wants. I can want something, but it didn't rise above the threshold for her unless that want was validated by somebody else.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like the people pleaser mentality. Right.
So all of our good girls, all of our people pleasers, and good boys. I happen to be married to a very good boy, golden child, good boy, people pleaser.
Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So if that's you, no, so that isn't actually, that's not my hang up. Like that's not my biggest point of growth. But when I hear that, I also am reminded that if we don't know how much we want, then it is guaranteed we did not design our relationships consciously based on the idea that we get to have needs and wants. If I don't even know what they are.
Oh, for sure.
Then how did I do that? And and then even if you aren't the person who's deciding like, I want to open up, maybe you're presented that idea by a partner. Maybe your partner comes home and presents this idea of opening, of being polyamorous, of swinging, of going to a play party, something like that. Well, you're in relationship with them. So now I would say it is time. If it was never time before, it's time now to get clear on what your wants, needs, and desires are. Because if your wants, needs, and desires aren't known, how will you actually be able to get to your authentic yes or your authentic no and really get there other than using just the cultural script of like, yeah, that sounds wrong, so we're not going to do that.
Right.
And that's a very different answer for your partner than saying, I've been with this. I've been digging in. I'm doing my work. You might still have a no, but that's just a whole different thing for your partner then to receive that no and be like, okay, I see that they are taking this in. They're doing the inner work. They're contemplating it and they can't meet me here. Okay. Now we have a different set of issues to work through, talk through, and it could lead to the breakdown, the ending of a relationship
Yeah.
or a reimagining. a complete reimagining.
Reimagining. Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows?
I think we also have to like normalize that because a relationship may not work, it doesn't mean that the two of you are bad.
Right. And it doesn't mean the relationship failed.
Right. And I feel like there's still so much of that stigma that exists in our world. And it makes me sad because I'm like, because we haven't been given the tools that we needed as children, and because we didn't understand the complexities of human emotion and relationships and how things play out, I'm like, people grow in relationships. People get into relationships and they learn about themselves. And if that allows them to change, but inevitably grow, you know, because that is meaning we're also growing.
Right.
And if that relationship is no longer functioning at the level where it continues to help us grow, because I feel like relationships should always help us grow, it is okay for that relationship to change.
Right.
And right. It doesn't mean that you're a failure.
It doesn't. I am so grateful to my first husband for being so clear. Like he had this intense clarity when I presented the idea of non-monogamy. He had intense clarity that it was a no for him. He did some work. We went to therapy. And when his no became really, really, really aware, it meant the end of our relationship as it was. It meant mm-hmm. we shifted into co-parenting. It meant it did wind up meaning a divorce because that's what we both chose. But most importantly, it meant that we shifted how we parented next to each other. I don't think either of us saw that coming, but you know, we homeschooled our kids and I don't think we saw that coming. And yet that's exactly what let us keep growing because we were going to get stuck. We were already stuck and giving each other the permission to be like, yeah, this doesn't work. Mm-hmm. This doesn't work. And so I love you. I release you. I love you. I release you. That is not the easiest work to do.
No.
But it also means that, yeah, the relationship was definitely not a failure because it produced the growth. It produced the individuation. It also produced, in my case, some beautiful children who I love very much. So it is a success. It's just,
yes.
It's just not the outcome we're told we're supposed to hope for. But I love my divorce. I'm so grateful for it. So grateful for it. And I love being married again, this time polyamorously, but like there are so many ways to do this thing called relationship.
Right.
But most of us don't really have skills built for that. We were presented with an image and we just try to mimic, right?
Yeah.
It's all mimicry. Like this is what I think people do. Yeah. Like this is what I think people do. I think this is what's right. That's what you see on, I think about all the close-up face shots on like the ultimatum, right? When they really close up on somebody's face, they're often saying something that they're like, but this is just how it is. Like this is just the truth. This is exactly how it is. Who said there is no one out there stamping our relationship card saying you're doing it correctly.
Yeah.
But it kind of feels like that when you're in relationship. It can feel like, oh, I have to do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
I love busting that up because the right way is going to, I totally agree with you. It's going to serve your growth. It's going to allow you to also truly show up for your partner's growth, which is not the easiest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And to acknowledge where you have work to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, part of reframing our stories, right, is recognizing where I feel like we're not giving each other any sort of goodness in the way of following these cultural norms and strict rules that actually throughout time might be causing us more harm than, but it's different for everyone. And so in my opinion, I say to people, I'm like, we have to remain curious. We have to remain open. What works for another person is not going to work for you.
Right.
Because we're different people and we need different things, and that's okay. The point is for us to be open to that person's experience and story, to learn about it, to listen, to hear, and I think just take from one another in that learning aspect of connecting instead of also then placing a sort of judgment and ridicule or different right. things like that, like there's so much beauty to be had with so many people in the way that they have come to learn and grow. And knowing that sometimes people learn and grow in a way that inevitably we're going to harm each other. Like we don't want to, but we're human and that's going to happen. We also want to do it in the, you know, in a way that's,
that doesn't like,
right. You know what I'm saying? And so, I don't know. I just get whenever I've done workshops and we talk about the boxes that we've had and we talk about how we're in them, inevitably people want to get rid of them. A lot of people do.
Right.
Overwhelmingly, there's some that are like, no, this feels good for me. This feels real safe. And that's right. okay. But I think overall people recognize that when we put these tiny little definitions on different large things that actually don't have the ability to be completely defined in a way that humans can completely understand, in my opinion. Right.
There is no objective. Yeah, there's no objective truth. There's just our subjective experience of right. like, oh,
yeah.
Oh, like, this is what relationships are?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know.
Right. Like people want to be able to have that more sense ability to reach beyond those borders or those walls that we have created, in my opinion. So from what I've been seeing in all of my workshops and things.
Yeah.
So.
And when you say some people find it, say some people are like, no, I'm good. I'm safe here. Yeah, mm-hmm. you are. And if safety is your primary mover right now,
yeah.
then great. Then you may find a particular cultural container that's fine. So Carl Jung is famous for saying that not everyone wants to individuate. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. If you, and the way he talked about it was about, if you find yourself in a cultural context where you feel held, nurtured, able to grow to the degree that feels good for you, like good, then you're good. You're in it. Essentially, you are in it the same way, you know, a deer is in the forest. They don't need mm-hmm. to go somewhere else or become more deer-like. They're good. They're fine. But if you don't find the cultural context holds you, then ouch. And a lot of times we find it holds us for just so long
mm-hmm.
and then it doesn't anymore. And right. so that's where the question of, okay, it has kept you safe. And now I want to ask, are you getting the growth that you actually want? Like, are you experiencing yeah. yourself as a becoming person? And mm-hmm. not everybody wants to do that. And yeah. that's, I mean, that was the bottom line. Like that mm-hmm. is the end of some relationships for me. That is the end of some relationships for my clients. They're like, oh, I specifically want to be with somebody who's growth oriented.
Right.
And maybe the partner I chose isn't. And I have to love them enough then to not force them onto my path.
Mm.
That's
yeah, that's
easy.
Interesting. I have to love yeah. them enough to not force them upon my path.
Mm. Yeah. Not easy.
Well, we have come to time. And so I ask each one of my guests, what story are you reframing today?
Mm. I'm going to go with my favorite one, given our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships can and should be designed by the people in them, for the people in them.
Mm.
End of story.
There it is. That's wonderful. How can people find you if they would like to learn more about your work and maybe work with you?
Yeah. So if you're curious about where you are on the curiosity spectrum of where are we ready to open? Could I actually do this? Is this even a thing for me? I have a 10-question quiz at joliquiz.com, joliquiz.com. And that 10-question quiz is designed to help you see, are you on the, I got a lot of foundational building to do, all the way over on the spectrum over to, hell yeah, we are good to go. Let's get into what are the steps? What do we actually do to do this well without burning mm-hmm. everything to the ground? So I encourage people to take that quiz. From the quiz, you'll be invited to join me for a free salon where I talk about the 5 pillars of opening up successfully. I love that salon. I run it once a month. And it's there for everyone. You don't have to be like, yeah, I definitely want to open. You might just be curious. So you can go take the quiz at joliquiz.com and then join us for the next salon.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining me today. And the work you do is really needed. And it was very informative for me. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Kara.